Hello out there, my friends. This is Tim Benall of BenallofAmerica.com with another edition of Benall of America Audio. It is June 3rd, 2006. We have a very special edition of Benall of America Audio for you on tap this week. It's Benall of America Audio taking on pop culture as only we can with James Gutman, author of World Wrestling Insanity. Before I got into the study of esoterica, I was a student of professional wrestling. I really loved the genre. I became fascinated with the inside workings of the business and really was fast on my way to becoming an astute wrestling historian in many ways. But of course, then I discovered the esoteric and I was dragged into the shadowy underworlds of conspiracy theory and UFOs. But since then, I've always seen the parallels between professional wrestling and the esoteric. Both operate on the fringes of the mainstream. Both operate in secrecy. Each has conspiracy theories, whistleblowers, and fine, dedicated researchers to dig into the genre and find out more information for the lay people out there. And that is who James Gutman is. He's a fantastic researcher. He's a great writer. He's got the new book, World Wrestling Insanity, where he takes a look at the strange state of American professional wrestling today. Many of you may remember wrestling from the last 6 years ago when it was super huge. Now, not so huge, but pretty bizarre. James is going to talk about why it's so bizarre. What's going on? What are the circumstances that lend itself to letting professional wrestling run so wildly out of control? That's what he discusses in World Wrestling Insanity, and that's what we're going to discuss this week here on Benall of America Audio. I want to welcome all the folks who are coming here from James's website, worldwrestlinginsanity.com. If you're a wrestling fan and you are not into conspiracy theory, you are missing out big time. So check out more Benall of America Audio. Also, I obviously want to welcome our longtime Benall of America Audio listeners. It's episodes like this and some of the other episodes so far this season that go off the beaten path that help us bring more diverse and fascinating esoteric researchers to the show. So if you're one of those longtime Benall of America Audio listeners and you're wringing your hands that I've got a pro wrestling guest on the show, trust me, folks, there's a method to my madness. It'll all play out in the end. You're going to enjoy the ride. If you are unfamiliar with James Gutman, here's a little bit about him. James Gutman grew up on Long Island and has been following the wrestling industry for as long as he can remember. His Raw Insanity is one of the internet's most beloved and controversial weekly wrestling columns. His new wrestling website, worldwrestlinginsanity.com, is fast becoming one of the most popular wrestling resources online. His work has been featured in numerous publications, including London Publishing's family of magazines. James is the author of World Wrestling Insanity, one of the best-selling books ever for ECW Press, and the highest-selling wrestling book so far that they've ever had, which is an amazing achievement. And he hosts the weekly audio series Radio Free Insanity every Friday at worldwrestlinginsanity.com, featuring discussion on wrestling news and events, along with interviews with a host of wrestling stars, both present-day performers and legends of the past. His website is worldwrestlinginsanity.com. The book is World Wrestling Insanity. The guest, James Gutman. Without any further ado, let's rock and roll, folks. This interview was conducted on May 30th, 2006. James Gutman on Benall of America Audio. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to a special edition of Benall of America Audio. James Gutman is the guest. He wrote the book, World Wrestling Insanity. It is about the decline and fall of a family empire, the World Wrestling Entertainment. You may have heard of it. I'm a longtime wrestling fan. Full disclosure, I helped James put up his radio show on worldwrestlinginsanity.com, so we're actually kind of friends and stuff. So I said to myself, I want to get James on the show, do a little pop culture style episode of Benall of America Audio. And as a longtime wrestling fan, I've always seen the parallels between professional wrestling and conspiracy-oriented stuff and the esoteric. There's a lot of work done in the shadows, if you will, and people are always trying to figure out what's going on, and the wrestling business is notoriously closed off to outsiders, which is pretty much kind of how the conspiracy-oriented people are, and we're trying to figure out what's going on with the behind-closed-doors situation, so you can kind of see the parallels there. And like I said, the guest this week, James Gutman, the book, World Wrestling Insanity. James, welcome to the show.
What's going on, Tim? Good to be on, man.
All right.
Let's talk a little bit first about your background, how you ended up writing a book about professional wrestling.
When I was younger, I did a wrestling newsletter right out of my house out here on Long Island. Nothing big. I was featured in, I think, Wrestling Eye magazine, New Wave Wrestling. It was called The Inside Informer. And it was cool because I was about 14, so I got a...
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I got some good interviews with people. At the time, I think I interviewed Jim Duggan right after he left WWF the first time. I had interviewed Lou Albano and people like that. So, I mean, it was fun, and I always enjoyed writing. Then, around the late 90s, kind of fell out of it. One of the guys that we had known out here, Vince Russo, was doing his radio show out on Long Island, and Vince had gotten kind of picked up with WWF and went there and started writing their shows. So it was kind of crazy in that sense, you know. In a way, I kind of felt like I had missed the boat, like I had stopped writing, and I was, you know, a little upset about it. But, you know, at that point, I was entering college, you know, getting parts of my life together.
Yeah.
Sometime after college, I had read the Pro Wrestling Torch was looking for writers to come review their shows and do a column on the site. So I had written to the editor. I expressed my interest, and I just continued to pump it out every week and try to make as many contacts as I can, get my name out there. I started writing for Pro Wrestling Illustrated magazine, and the wrestling and things like that. So. It was kind of the situation where I just kept writing and writing and writing until I was at the point where I felt I was doing good enough that I would really want to go out and try to branch out to a book.
Nice, nice. So you like sort of started out slow and then just became a wrestling writer over time.
Yeah, I mean, it was the kind of thing that I'd always wanted to do it. I mean, everyone kind of has an idea, I think, deep down, something that they think they might be pretty good at. And I've always enjoyed writing, even in school. You know, everyone would complain, oh, I got to write a paper, I got to write this. And I used to love writing papers. I wasn't big on tests, but writing papers and writing reports or really just trying to look below the surface of where everyone else is looking were kind of things that always intrigued me.
Yeah. And we'll talk a little bit about professional wrestling itself. Because, like, in the book, you sort of talk about how it's hard just to even tell people you write about professional wrestling. There's a stigma attached to it that, in a lot of ways, helps them remain sort of in the background, but also hurts them in a lot of ways because people sort of don't take them seriously or just crap on them.
Oh, exactly. I mean, you said in the beginning about the parallels between the conspiracy world and the wrestling world. And, I mean, I totally agree with you. I think one of the sad things about both situations is that, like, in the conspiracy world, conspiracies will pop up that, you know, you'll hear about them, and I watch a lot of these documentaries or whatnot, and I'll say, well, there's so many valid points in there, and there's so much validity to what that person is saying. And then you tell somebody who is above it all, so to speak, and really isn't into that, and you say, well, they have this proof and they have that proof. Well, that guy's a nut. And it's like, well, that's your only response, and it's the same thing with wrestling. You know, you turn around to people and you say, these people don't have a union, these people are dying, these people are being embarrassed on television, you know, these people are losing money, their families, you know, they're going from being on television to being broke or being drug addicts, and they go, well, I don't watch wrestling.
Yeah.
And you go, what the hell does that have to do with anything, whether or not, you know? And it's kind of sad in a situation like that because you kind of get the situation that we have now with pro wrestling, which is that there is one major company, there's one major person running the companies, and that person kind of has carte blanche to do as he pleases because there are absolutely no checks and balances anymore.
Yeah, yeah. And there's a lot of wrestling books out there. What made you sort of hone in on this particular topic and sort of flesh out the theme of World Wrestling Insanity?
Well, one of the things that I wrote the book in mind to do was reach out to a new audience. And I'm really happy the way it is, like doing this show here. And ECW Press, who's the publisher, have a lot of future reviews and interviews set up with outlets that are not wrestling-oriented.
Yeah.
I kind of wrote it in a way that it's an overview of the company to somebody who's never watched professional wrestling or somebody who really has never really understood professional wrestling. But at the same time, I tried to write it in a way that people who do watch wrestling can still learn from it and get things out of it. I think WWE right now is, I mean, obviously they're the most well-known company as far as wrestling goes in America, you know, North America right now.
Yeah.
So I wanted to focus on them. I don't really like to focus too highly on independent wrestling just because for the amount of people who go and follow it, it really isn't worth it. If you're going to write a book or if you're going to write an online article, I like to try to focus on the bigger, to get to more people. And I thought that with the way WWE has been running for the last few years, it's been kind of peculiar because we've watched it and we've followed it as it goes along and we watch Raw and we watch SmackDown and we say, well, that's ridiculous and they did this and that's ridiculous and that's ridiculous. But when I sat down to put it all into a book, one after another after another, it really just struck me with how many ridiculous things continuously happen. And when you put it all together, it stands out. So that's one of the reasons why I wanted to focus on the company I focused on.
Yeah. And sort of like you allude to, the present state of affairs in wrestling in America today, really, for people like who don't follow it, like you say, they last remember it maybe towards the late 90s when it was really big, and that was the boom period. And then subsequently, there were three leagues at the time. The two other leagues pretty much went out of business. WWF at the time is also confusing. WWF, they put the other two leagues out of business. Then they had to change their name, which never really seemed to stick with the mainstream audience. And for the last 5 years, they've been the sole owner almost of professional wrestling in America.
Yeah.
And the result of that is one family, pretty much this crazy, kooky family, the McMahon family, owning wrestling and having, as you said, carte blanche over what's going on, what you see on TV.
Mm-hmm. Oh, totally. I mean, this is and the thing that I definitely want to differentiate for people who don't watch the product is that the complaints aren't what the McMahons are choosing to put on TV. Like, my issue isn't, I don't like the wrestler that they want to put the world title on. It's not like that. What's actually happened is since the buyout of WCW, and actually, since the late 90s, the McMahon family became characters on television, the family as a whole, including Stephanie's husband, Triple H, who's a performer. And as I say in the book, it's the kind of situation where when you're in a business where everybody's playing characters, and those characters remain their personas throughout the day. It's not like a TV show where, Mr. Belvedere is just Mr. Belvedere when he's on TV. It's, Hulk Hogan is always Hulk Hogan. Triple H is always Triple H. So these people, they develop not only egos, but a failure to kind of separate who they are from who they play on television. And because of that, when they go out there and they want to portray their characters on TV, they like to look as good as possible. And it changes so much of how the product comes out on television, because these people are doing things that aren't consistent with their characters. They aren't consistent with, logical flow of stories and on-air segments. If anything, it becomes more or less of an ego show. And that's what's really happened. Free from the companies that you mentioned that were competing against them, WWE doesn't really have to worry about somebody breathing down their neck and taking away their audience. So for the last few years, there's many cases where Monday Night Raw and SmackDown and the pay-per-views have become nothing more than McMahon family-owned videos put on television to air grudges.
Exactly. Exactly. And one of the key changes, it seems, in the past few years has been, and it's McMahon-related also, is Stephanie McMahon took over the WWE writing staff. Mm-hmm. And I've always sort of noticed, and maybe you can speak to this, that there's a sort of a paradox has gone on where WWE's programming, it used to be it was a wrestling show, and now it's more sort of a show about a wrestling company.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that's a result of them bringing in these outside writers who don't understand professional wrestling. They're Hollywood writers, and it's producing a lot of more grotesque storylines and contradictory type storylines where they reveal the show as a show, but then sort of go back and forth.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's the thing that we have to remember, and it's funny because the big excuse that everyone has for, as you said, grotesque storylines is that Vince McMahon is big on potty humor. He always has been. I've spoken to people who know the family, and they say he's always been like that. He likes poop. He likes, all the gross jokes and things like that. But what those people fail to realize is that, obviously, that didn't happen overnight. He's always been like that, and he's always liked potty humor. Why is it more prevalent now? It's prevalent now because he knows, and I guess he's always known, that his audience really wasn't into that, and he couldn't put it on TV even though he enjoyed it. And now, as we said before, free of competition, it's more or less what he wants to see as opposed to what others want to see.
Yeah.
I think the problem with the McMahons, I'm not going to get into nepotism and things like that, because I do find a lot of times that, at least in a situation like this, Vince McMahon did recreate wrestling in the 80s. He came in, he took over the company from his father, and he really made it what it was. The issue that does spring up with Stephanie and to a point Shane is that, they are just the children of the McMahon family. They're not necessarily, they didn't revolutionize anything. Stephanie really hasn't produced anything on television where I can say, good job, Steph, you deserve the spot that you have. So there is a proving period that they still have to kind of work out, and they haven't proven really much of anything yet. WWE has had an infatuation with not being a wrestling company, which is silly when you consider that anybody who doesn't watch the product knows that it's a wrestling company.
Yeah.
They want to be a soap opera. They want to be a TV show about a wrestling company. But while doing that, they forget that you have to follow certain rules within that world. If you're scripting a drama or a comedy, you have to follow the rules within that drama or comedy. If there's a show, like let's say The Office, the show The Office on NBC is about an office. That's fine, but you can't have things happening in that office that aren't consistent with what should happen in an office.
Yeah.
And that's what WWE runs into. Like, you can't do a show about a wrestling company, and for a while they were taking the Cruiserweight Championship, a title that's supposed to be there to give your cruiserweight something to do on the show, and they had put it on a woman, they put it on a 55-year-old man because they think it's funny, but they're failing to realize that it then cheapens a whole division of your, albeit pretend, you know, storyline-oriented world, but you're cutting your own legs out from underneath you, and WWE isn't cutting their own legs out all for the sake of trying to be something they're not and something that their fan base doesn't want them to be anyway.
Yeah. And you speak to them cutting their own legs off from them. They've left a lot of money on the table to satisfy personal grudges over the last five years or so, wouldn't you say?
Definitely, definitely. Guys like, I mean, and that's, I think the saddest thing is that WWE a few years ago spent a lot of money to bring in a guy named Bill Goldberg. A lot of fans know him, even those that don't really follow wrestling, because he was big in WCW in the late 90s. Bill Goldberg and Sting are probably the two most prominent non-WWE created names. And they brought in Goldberg, and even people who didn't like Goldberg were intrigued by the idea, because here was a guy, and his character really, it was based on just squashing people and killing them and beating everybody in his way. And the big question was, how is WWE going to make this character work while not killing their whole roster by letting Goldberg beat them? And we got our answer fairly quickly, was that they weren't going to let the character work, so it didn't matter anyway. Bill Goldberg, actually, years before coming to WWE, had a high-profile exchange with Triple H at an autograph signing where he stood 10 feet away and cursed Hunter out. Triple H married into the McMahon family. So here's this guy coming in, instant heat, instantly not liked by the powers that be. And there were so many opportunities throughout his feud against Triple H where you watched it, and even if you weren't a Goldberg fan, you said, wow, if he were to win the world title right there, that would be great. And they just left money on the table. They didn't give him the belt. And when they did finally give him the belt, they kind of bogged him down with silly and weird storylines that didn't focus on him, all for the sake of revenge, when they probably could have made a couple of pennies off of his name had he been marketed right.
Yeah. Goldberg's sad case sort of falls in with a big part of your book. And I dub it here in the notes here as Triple H conspiracy theory. So, and this conspiracy is in everything. If you look hard enough, and if you've been a student of any sport, you've heard different conspiracy theories. But this one's sort of the conspiracy theory du jour, and that's Triple H. He's had quite a history in the last 5 years on WWE, and most of it makes no sense and only seems to benefit him. And the question always is he doing it himself? Is his wife, Stephanie McMahon, he married into the family? Are they so crazy and over the top that they're just completely ruining their show to satisfy just this one guy? So speak to that a little bit. What your take is on the Triple H conspiracy theory, because you do a lot of work towards that in the book.
Well, it's funny. One of the reasons why I did that, if you read the book, it almost seems at points like overkill with the amount of things that I list that Triple H has done. And one of the reasons why is that, having reviewed the show, I started reviewing Monday Night Raw in October of 2002 when I first began, and I watched it every week, and I kept thinking, this guy is just doing these things to these performers where I can't understand why no one's seeing this. You know, it was to the point where you can't even rationalize a good reason why it's being done other than to make him look good. And still you have fans that argue, and wrestling fans, I find that a lot of the time they like to debate. Even if a subject is more or less cut and dry, they still like to debate and go on both sides.
Yeah.
And one of the big things I read all the time was, well, Triple H still helps people, and he still did this, and he still did that. So when I sat down to write the book out, I said, well, let's just do this. Let's go from October 2002, a full year before the guy got married, until the book was due in, which was right around the time that the world title that he apparently was obsessed with left his show to go to the other brand. And let's see how many people he helped, and let's see how his storylines played out. And it ended up being a type of thing where I probably could have written half the amount that I've written, and it would have been sufficient, and it would have probably gotten people to say, well, it's probably true, but I didn't want any wiggle room. I wanted that if Triple H does read the book or the McMahons read the book, they can really look at it and say, you know, this is from beginning to end, every single thing that I had observed and where it stood. And unless the guy is just inept and doesn't understand the business and doesn't understand anything about helping anyone else in the business, then it's on purpose, you know? I have a lot of respect for Triple H. He was a great wrestler before he was in the McMahon family. He's always been a top performer. This isn't a case of a guy coming off the street, marrying the boss's daughter, and becoming a world champion. He was the main eventer before he got married. It was the issue that sprung up. It wasn't that he got title shots or got pushed because of being a part of the McMahon family. The issue was that his character eventually devoured the entire show because he was a member of the McMahon family. That's the problem.
Yeah. Sort of talk a little bit more about this. WWE, they hate wrestling in a sort of another weird paradox that pervades that whole business. They hate professional wrestling, it seems. How pervasive is that culture of sort of anti-wrestling inside the WWE, and why do you think it even exists? That makes no sense.
I think at the end of the day, I think the problem comes with the McMahons not liking the wrestling business. I think they blame it for a lot of how they're viewed by others. I think Vince McMahon handles himself very peculiarly outside of the business sometimes. When he went on HBO with Bob Costas and he got in his face, or when he slapped the notes out of the hand of a guy on Real Sport. I mean, he's done such crazy stuff publicly. And I think he's kind of convinced himself, especially after the demise of the XFL, that a lot of it had to do with the public's perception of his business and the professional wrestling. And although I think that's always kind of been there, where he always kind of felt like he was more than a wrestling promoter and that wrestling promoters were looked down upon, I think after the XFL, he took it personally. And he views it as such, in that he doesn't want to just be seen as a wrestling promoter because he thinks that might be negative publicity. So they went out and they hired a lot of people who don't love the wrestling industry. They're here to make TV.
Yeah.
And I've talked to people in the company who say, you know, I'm not a wrestling guy, I'm a TV guy. Oh, okay. And just like I mentioned in the book, I'm somebody who, you know, I love the business. And even I have a hard time sometimes telling people, you know, what I'm involved in and what I write about. So you can only imagine people who work for WWE who don't love the wrestling industry and what they tell people at the end of the day.
Oh, God.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's trying to make themselves happy at the expense of their own product. And Vince has gone out there and he's tried bodybuilding federations. He's sold IcaPro workout supplements. He's done the XFL, CDs, movies, you name it. He's tried to do it. But at the end of the day, many of his fans tune in to see wrestling. Maybe not in-ring wrestling, and maybe not everybody loves headlocks and dropkicks, but people want to see storylines that make them more excited to buy a match later on. In the end, you're selling matches. You're not selling really anything else. TV and everything else is being done to build up your matches, your pay-per-views, and your characters. So when you're, you know, focusing a whole show on a segment or a skit that's maybe funny or dramatic, but it doesn't have anything to do with a character or a feud or a match, it's, as we said before, cutting your own legs out from under you, all because you don't want to admit what you really do for a living.
Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And you think that goes from top to bottom? There's just people in, like you said, just TV guys. So it's not just like the top people hate it, but the other people are like fans and that got into it. There's a lot of it's top to bottom pretty much, you think?
Well, I think that the people who do stand tall and defend the business within the company aren't really treated with the most respect. I mean, Jim Ross totally comes to mind right off the bat. He's somebody who really does love wrestling. And I think Jim Ross actually inspired a lot of what I do to get involved in wrestling. He used to have a radio show back in the early 90s. He did it for WCW, and then when he went to WWFE, they did it for him too. And he once had this caller call in and thank him. It was a guy, and he was blind, and he actually thanked Jim Ross, for calling the matches the way he does. He says, "I feel like I can watch it because of how you describe it." And I remember listening to that thinking, "Oh, that's so cool." You know, I mean, that's somebody who loves what they do, and they go out there, and they describe it, and they do their job in a way that puts that through to somebody who can't even see the product.
Yeah.
And, I mean, so Jim Ross has been up and down the UWF, WCW. He's worked everywhere. And he is into wrestling. And, unfortunately, you saw it on television last year. And a lot of times you'll read, you know, comments or whatnot. But people like that, they kind of get, I want to say, picked on or looked down upon within the company because of it. But it's such a backwards mentality. It's the type of place where, even though they're a wrestling company, if you work for them and you love the wrestling, you get mocked and you get ridiculed. And it's just so silly. It's like, you know, IBM, you know, treating people who love computers like crap in their office.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's your job, it's your company. You know, you should respect that and be happy that you have them on the payroll, but they don't.
Yeah, it's really bizarre. It's one of the most frustrating aspects of that company. the WWE, they went through a pretty significant change about 5 or 6 years ago, and that's when they went from a privately owned company to a corporate monster in some ways. As a publicly owned company, they took their stock public. How do you think that changed the wrestling business that people used to be familiar with? It's certainly gone corporate in some ways.
Oh, very much so. I mean, one of the guys who writes for the site and is in the book is Tom Pritchard, who was WWE's head trainer. He was, co-host of Fight This, their talent show. He's a former wrestler and all that. He was a big part of WWE, and he's one of the most far removed from corporate America type guys you could find. He's not really, he doesn't wear the suit and tie work or anything like that. And he was definitely a casualty of that crossover. WWE, again, still in their desire to not be a wrestling company, have taken more of a corporate outlook on the thing. They brought in a guy, John Laurinaitis, who's known for making corporate decisions about his employees that are almost silly when you consider all the other problems they have going on. I think the one thing that's changed, at least in my opinion, because I'm not big on numbers and I'm not big on financials and things like that. That's their deal.
Yeah.
The big change that I have found is that WWE tends to try to find excuses more. And you see it because Linda McMahon does a conference call with investors every quarter. And when she does, some of the things that just come out of their mouths are just so funny because you know what's true and you know what's not true. And you watch the way they kind of phrase it and the way they put certain things here and certain things there. WWE has made a habit out of not really taking too big of a loss because they know where to bring money in from other avenues. People stop coming to shows, they're going to sell more DVDs.
Yeah.
People stop buying DVDs, they're going to run more shows overseas. You know, I mean, so that's, they're good in that sense. They know how to make the money balance out at the end of the day, but at the same time, they're also trying to snow a lot of people who maybe don't follow the business all that closely and don't really understand the true answers to a lot of the questions they have during those conference calls.
Yeah, yeah. We'll be talking about a lot of these problems in the wrestling business, and you can't really not give some of the blame to the wrestlers themselves. It's sort of a boys' club. There's a lot of hazing. There's a lot of paranoia. And it's even another strange thing that I noticed from reading the book is that there's two guys in there. You talk to a number of wrestlers. There's great quotes in the book. And what sort of struck my interest was that you talk to two guys. I won't say, so then you pick up the book and read it, and then you'll know who I'm talking about.
All right.
But you talk to two guys. They weren't in the WWE at the time. They really don't have anything good to say about WWE. But since then, I've seen both of them back on WWE, one in sort of a sporadic capacity. He'll show up every now and again as a legend.
Mm-hmm.
And the other guy pretty much is back on the payroll and was a full-time wrestler. And neither one of them had very good things to say about them. Some of them were really biting remarks. And it's sort of it's interesting that they'll leave. They'll have all these things to say, but then they'll end up coming back. Is that obviously that's sort of part of the WWE owns the wrestling business, so they pay the most and everything.
Absolutely.
But the wrestlers, they have to compromise themselves a lot, and it's a culture of like I said, just a boys' club. So speak to some of the problems that are caused by the wrestlers themselves, and how that does not go unnoticed in the book.
Oh, absolutely. I think, I mean, right then and there, the statement that they call themselves the boys, I think that just, it says it all right there. I think the wrestling industry, it has a locker room very similar to a football team or any sports team because it is sports entertainment, and there is a certain aspect of it that involves sports, and that aspect is that they do physical activity in the ring. They have to be in somewhat good enough shape that they can fall on their back over and over again each night and not, you know, die.
Yeah.
So they go out there, and they have that sports mentality. They're on the road together, and they want to haze each other, and that's cool, and I'm definitely not anti-hazing, and I try to make this clear, and it's in the book, too. I've been involved in teams and fraternities, things like that. So I understand the need to kind of haze somebody. The problem that comes up here is that it's not just hazing. It's almost this whole recess-like mentality of, you know, you have to put your bag a certain place. You have to shake this guy's hand. You got to shake that guy's hand. Otherwise, they're going to, you know, tie you to a pole, or they're going to make you serve drinks on an airplane or something like that.
Yeah.
And that's all silly and well and good. And there's a lot worse things that they do make people do. I mean, I've heard worse stories than that. The issue that springs up is that these guys are independent contractors. And football teams, baseball teams, I mean, they're all in unions.
Yeah.
You know, wrestlers don't have unions. Wrestlers don't have health insurance. Wrestlers don't have pension plans. And while management sits back and allows these guys to kind of play that game with each other of, hey, you didn't shake my hand, and I'm going to kick your ass, and that kind of thing, at the end of the day, I mean, they should be working together, not against each other. And if they did work together, it would solve so many problems, you know. Everybody asks about the drug problem in wrestling. Everybody asks about the health problem in wrestling. And that could all be solved through a union, you know. The problem that does spring up, is that they're almost proud of what they are. They're proud of being the boys, and they're proud of the boys' club mentality. And it seems as though this industry, which began in the carnivals and began in the carny days, has evolved for the promoters. It's gone from them making, you know, $5 and step right up to, you know, making billions of dollars in their company. But for some reason, the performers, not only are they exactly the same position that they were when they were in the carnivals, they're proud of being in the exact same position. And I've talked to some of these people, and you ask them about unions, and they go, oh, if we get a union, everybody's going to, you know, there's just going to be somebody else to step up. And it's like, well, isn't that the point of every union? Isn't that why you have a union? Because there is that fear, you know, if any organization could turn around and say that and say, you know, well, we're not going to form a policeman's union because what happens if we go on strike? There's going to be tons of civilians that want to become policemen. And it's like, well, yeah, but that's kind of the point. That's why you do it. And in wrestling, I don't know what it's going to take, and I don't know what generation is finally going to turn around and say, I've had enough of how we're treated. I've had enough of the fact that I don't agree with this company, and now I have to work for them, or I'm going to starve, or I'm going to be bad-mouthed on a DVD, or I'm going to, you know, never have my name mentioned again in public.
Yeah.
It's depressing in that sense, and you feel for a lot of these guys. A lot of the heroes that I grew up watching and that, you know, you probably grew up watching are nowhere even close to where you would have expected them to be when you were, 10 years old.
Oh, I know. I know. It's very sad to see where some of these guys end up.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of goes to something that I've pointed out to a lot of people that a lot of mainstream people who follow wrestling don't understand is that these guys, it sounds like they make a lot of money, but actually they spend a lot of money to do what they do. They have to pick up a lot of the costs that you wouldn't think that they do, you know.
Mm-hmm.
This is a year-round thing. They're spending money out of pocket that comes from their salary, and it's a significant portion. So you've talked to a lot of wrestlers. Talk a little bit about how much of that expense they have to pick up and in general.
Well, I mean, the company's usually pretty good with reimbursing on things like that.
Really?
There's expenses that kind of get factored into everything. I mean, everybody gets, you know, expensed. I mean, they're obviously not giving them tons and tons of money to do things, but you kind of have enough if you want to stay somewhere and you want to get food. The problem then comes in is a lot of these guys, they live this superstar lifestyle.
Yeah.
And Mick Foley, I think, spoke about this in his book. Foley was notorious for being, thrifty, I guess you could say, and saving a lot of his expense money so that, you know, he can go back home to his family. But a lot of these guys, I mean, they're on television, they say, oh, you know, I want to be whatever, so they go out and they buy sunglasses and leather jackets or whatever, and then at the end of the day, the checks stop coming, you know? I mean, it's not, they think it's going to last forever, and when you're in that moment, it kind of seems like it's going to last forever. There's people that you'll watch on TV every week, and then when they're gone, it's like they never existed. And a lot of them aren't prepared for that. It's a lot like these Hollywood stars. You know, they go out there and they're on television and they're mega stars and, you know, where's the money ever going to go? And next thing you know, you're Corey Haim and you're 30 and you're doing VH1's top 50 child star shows, you know?
Yeah.
And that's the issue. And a lot of them, too, they developed the addiction to painkillers. That was just, it was actually just dealt with on The Surreal Life. I don't know if you watch the show, but Maven was on it.
Mm-hmm.
And Maven was in WWE, and they had a whole episode, not really a whole episode, but a portion dealing with his addiction to painkillers. And this is a guy who's been wrestling for 5 years. Could you imagine these guys who've been doing it for 30 years and actually winning matches on, like, Maven? You know, I mean, it's sad the way they go into this business wide-eyed with a lot of dreams, and a lot of these guys, actually almost all of them, come out of it very different than when they first got in.
That actually segues perfectly, sadly, into the next talking point, which is the death epidemic in professional wrestling. This is just sort of starting to get a little bit of mainstream coverage in the last year or so, and but it's actually been going on for like 5, 6, 7, almost a decade now. A lot of young wrestlers dropping dead. A lot of the people that were superstars back in the day that you're shocked and stunned when you find out they died. But if you're a longtime wrestling fan, an inside wrestling fan, you're not so much shocked, but there's a desensitization to the whole thing now at this point. But talk a little bit about that. Some people may have heard about this problem But other people, this might be news to them. So talk about the wrestling death epidemic.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, the mortality rate for professional wrestling under the age of, I think it's 40, is ridiculously high. Well above. I mean, I don't give a percentage unless I know for sure what it is today. Yeah. But, I mean, it's high. And it's a lot of guys. I mean, you go through Mr. Perfect and Big Boss Man and Rick Rude and Miss Elizabeth. I mean, it's like a who's who of when we were kids, you know, coming out there. And then they all pass away. I mean, the issue and one of the reasons why it's been hard to get the issue noticed is because I think those of us who do try to make people aware of it, a lot of times we tend to kind of get lost when doing it. I think a lot of the things that we use as points cheapen it. And one example that I'll give you, and I hear that a lot whenever people are talking about wrestlers who passed away, and they brought it up on HBO when they did the story on it, people bring up the Junkyard Dog, who hadn't been wrestling for WWE for about 6-7 years at the time of his death and died in a car accident, you know? And then people come out there and they say, well, these wrestlers died in the Junkyard Dog. And it's like, well, Junkyard Dog doesn't really count, you know? I mean, just because a wrestler did die before 40 doesn't mean it's part of the problem. I mean, it is definitely, it's a sad situation and it should be brought up, but it's not Vince McMahon's fault. And that's where he kind of gets the wiggle room, is that when wrestlers die off of his watch, he says, well, they weren't working for me anymore. I can't be blamed for it, blah, blah. I think that, again, I mean, it all goes back to unions. I think if they had unions, they had better health care. If they had better health care, better pensions, they wouldn't have to be doing some of the things they were doing to keep their bodies moving after they were done with the ring. I think the issue that really kind of annoys people, and it came up last year, was when Eddie Guerrero passed away, and WWE kind of used it for fodder, for on-air kind of storyline and scripts. That was probably one of the most deeply offensive things I've ever seen WWE do on so many levels, because as somebody who runs a website, I dealt with emails from readers who were destroyed over, you know, Eddie Guerrero dying. A lot of people had never really dealt with death before. They never had anybody that they watched on TV or followed pass away, so it really affected them deeply. And then for the McMahons to come out and script promos where Randy Orton says that Eddie Guerrero's in hell, or have Rey Mysterio use Eddie Guerrero's name to become a popular star, it's like, well, that's kind of, you know,
wrong,
disturbing, and especially for the fact that he died on their watch. Like, I'm not a wrestling promoter, but if I had a company and one of my employees died on my watch, I would be too embarrassed to mention their name outside of, you know, in a respectable way for a while. I mean, is there any responsibility on their heads, even whether or not we blame them or not? Because, I mean, you know, once in a while something will happen in your life that you're not responsible for, but you feel responsible for.
Yeah.
And you need your friends to say, you know, well, it's not your fault. In this case, it's kind of like that with the McMahon family. Like, whether or not you believe they are at fault for the death of Eddie Guerrero, what do they think in their heart? Obviously, it doesn't affect them that much if they're going to make it part of their silly little storylines. You're going to go from a bikini contest to a segment about, you know, Eddie Guerrero, who died 3 months earlier, right after. I mean, it's like, where's the decorum and where's the reverence, you know, the respect for somebody who worked for you and passed away? And I think it's that arrogance that fuels a lot of the people who come down on McMahon for the deaths in wrestling. And I think if he would accept the situation for what it truly is, instead of always trying to back out of it and always trying to blame someone else or whatnot, and just accept, look, it's not 100% my fault, but it is real. It is something that we care about. And even some sort of policy or some sort of statement on it, I think fans might respect it more. I think a lot of what the WWE does, they do to get a reaction as opposed to doing what might necessarily be right morally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like you said, all that stuff that they did to exploit the death of Eddie Guerrero, that could have been stopped from the top on down. So you really have to ask yourself, like, you know, why didn't they step in? And be like, you know, this shouldn't be going on. And they didn't. And, you know, draw your own conclusions from that.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the tough things, especially about being somebody who reviews the industry, is that you never want to question anything that you don't know 100%. Just because, and for example, the Eddie Guerrero Memorial episode of Raw, I reviewed it, I kept it respectable, I didn't question anybody's emotions that night, I didn't question anybody's feelings, but there were definite situations where people who, you know, were probably, you know, within the company connected to a certain extent, were saying things that didn't really sit well with me. You know, little things that can be misconstrued as dramatic for dramatic purposes, things yeah. that can be misconstrued as, you know, still trying to keep it winky-winky insider wrestling talk while I'm delivering, you know, a pseudo-eulogy for somebody. You know, even Vince McMahon at the beginning of the show, you know, he said, Viva La Raza! And he kind of said it in a way that it was like, well, it was kind of inappropriate.
Yeah.
Maybe you're a nut. I don't know, Vince. You know, I don't know where it comes from. But then within a week, you go on WWE Shop Zone, where they're selling their merchandise, and there's Eddie Guerrero with a big sign that says, Viva La Savings. You know, and it's like, yeah. where did that come from? You know, at one point, are they so far removed from society, and they've been living in that, you know, Titan Tower WWE bubble so long that they can't see right from wrong in a traditional sense? And that's what you have to wonder.
Yeah. This is something interesting that I wanted you to speak to, and you covered it in the book a lot, too. And I've noticed it as a longtime fan, back when I first started watching wrestling, which was like 88, you couldn't even get a decent wrestling book. If you were lucky, there was maybe one radio show in your area, and it was on like 4 in the morning.
Mine was, yeah, 3 a.m. on FAN.
Yeah, yeah, and it was only an hour long, and it was once a week. And, you know, the wrestling magazines were usually like 6 weeks behind and still pretending it was real, so you just could not really get any information on wrestling. And now, in the last 20 years or so, since I started watching wrestling, there's become an economy of insidership, is how I dubbed it. And we're talking about the newsletters, radio shows like your show on WorldWrestlingInsanity.com, tons of books, obviously your book, World Wrestling Insanity, shoot tapes that are like this new form of entertainment that has become really big in wrestling. Talk a little bit about the evolution of wrestling and how this economy of insidership has sort of sprung up out of nowhere with the birth of the internet, obviously, and then, you know, all this subsequent stuff.
Well, it's funny because I feel like it's been an avenue that could have made money a long time ago. And one of the only reasons I think it wasn't more prevalent was because of that fear that, you know, you kind of got to keep kayfabe, as they say in the wrestling industry. You got to keep secret, which is basically, you know, what people mean when they say kayfabe. So they want to keep the secrets within the industry. I remember I was in eighth grade, first time I saw a copy of the Wrestling Observer. This kid had it, and to me, it was like the most amazing thing I'd ever seen in my life. Like,
yeah.
You know, I was like, wow, I can't believe this guy has all that. Just the fact, excuse me, that he had real names in it, I was like, wow, somebody's real names in there. I think what ended up happening was, you know, WWE themselves, back when they were WWF, admitted in the mid-80s that they were fake. They came out, they said it was scripted, it was choreographed, Vince did it to kind of get around some athletic commission rules and regulations.
Yeah.
It was to the point where in the late 90s when Vince appeared on Real Sports with Bob Costas during one of those crazy Vince McMahon HBO interviews, Costas had asked him how much of his audience, what percentage, believe wrestling is still real, and he said, maybe 2%. You know, so this is before, I mean, I ever got involved in it. That's why I always find it funny when they say, well, the internet's killing wrestling. It's like, well, Vince admitted it in the mid-80s. He admitted it again in the late 90s. I mean, the entire late 90s was built around the fact that wrestling wasn't, you know, real. It was supposed to be scripted.
Yeah.
I think the internet had a huge hand in it, and it has really nothing to do with the people on the internet. It just has to do with the tool that is the internet.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I was talking to somebody the other day, and we can't even remember what it was like growing up when you weren't able to say to yourself, you know, who was that actor in that movie, and be able to look it up immediately.
Yeah.
You know, we take it for granted now. You know, Encyclopedia Britannica, we had a whole set of encyclopedias in my house that were, you know, doing reports with seven-year-old information, you know, in this long set. The internet's there for people who like a certain thing. And whereas before you would probably have to talk to somebody to find out how to get a copy of The Observer or find out inside news or call a hotline, now anything you ever want to know about anything ever is on the internet. I just found the original scripts to The Karate Kid 2 online. I said, I can't believe this is online. And it's like that with wrestling. I mean, if somebody likes wrestling, they're going to look it up online. If they look it up online, they don't want to read the same stuff that they already know from television. They don't want to read the stuff that was in the magazines when we were kids. You know, if somebody's reading something online, they want to know as much as they can.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's like that with video games. It's like that with movies, TV shows. The internet has changed the way, not just that we deal with wrestling, but the way we deal with the world around us. And the McMahons and the WWE has still failed to realize that. And they still kind of treat the internet like maybe it was true in the late 90s and that it was a small fringe part of the business and it really wasn't that important. The internet's become as important to people today as television, you know. So to turn around and to discredit it, is a silly move, but it also explains why it is where it is right now, and it's because, you know, society moves on, technology moves on, and the business needs to move on, and that's, I think, what's brought us to where we are now, and so many people are trying to cash in when they can.
Yeah.